This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
So tonight's lecture is called Navigating Restless Years, St. Augustine on How to Survive Young Adulthood. And as a way into this, I want to give an image for you guys, an image of a duck, and in particular, a duck gliding across the water. So researchers at Stanford, as well as students at Stanford, have coined this term, the duck syndrome. Has anyone heard of the duck syndrome before? All right, don't give it away. But it's a picture that talks about, I think, captures some of the lived experience of young people, of emerging adults. If you see a duck gliding across the water, it's graceful, it's kind of beautiful in its mallardness, and it appears great. And on the surface, so many young people appear to be doing great. They are crushing it. They are balancing pressures of work, family, school, the future, and so much of this is put out on social media. You look at their Instagram, and again, they are crushing it. Sunsets, brunches, seeing cool live bands, local breweries, thoughtful takes on films, nuanced political opinions, good times with attractive people. And it seems like the future is just full of wonderful prospects and opportunities. But if you've ever seen a duck's legs when it's like under the water, it's not so graceful. A duck's legs are frantic under the water. They're kicking about gracelessly. It's a mess. And this idea, the duck syndrome, is while outside people, young people, are appearing to look great, beneath the surface, people are reporting higher rates of anxiety, of depression, of feeling as though life is lacking meaning. They're ruled by tyrannous emotions. They're unsure about how they can get a purpose to life that is longer lasting and more durable than a romantic relationship, a job, good grades. And so in a word, young people are restless. Emerging adults feel restless. And being a young adult emerging out of adolescence, you come into this complex season of life. And it's a difficult season of differentiation. You're sort of grabbing the wheel for the first time in your life, and you're setting a course for yourself. And these years are filled with lots of mistakes, lots of false starts, and a lot of heartache. Our author and psychologist Meg Jay, in her book, The Defining Decade, Why Your 20s Matter and How to Make the Most of Them, she gives this really interesting image because she's about where some of these mistakes come from, because she says, developmentally, our brains are lopsided. They haven't fully formed yet. The front of our brain, the part that says, maybe we should slow down and make a pros and cons list about what we should do, is trying to catch up with a larger part of your brain, back of your brain, that's like a nonstop party that's screaming at you, you only live once, like, let's do this, like, let's have fun. And so this means these years can be exciting, but they can also be turbulent. Again, filled with false starts, with heartbreaks, with headaches, and lots of soul searching. And they're often haunted by big questions like, who are my people? What is true? Where is my place? What do I want? What should I do with myself? And who am I? And so into this restless season, this age, my hope tonight is to sort of commend a companion in a very old book, an old, old book, The Confessions by St. Augustine of Hippo, a brilliant 4th century African bishop. And now, apart from what I think about this book is a big deal. It is a watershed in the development of Western culture. It is the single most read, reread, and quoted post-biblical book ever written. While there's some scholarly debate on how we go about categorizing this book, and we can put a flag in that, we'll return to that later, it's often understood and presented as the first autobiography in the Western tradition. So not only is it kind of a genre-defining work, it's a genre-creating work, in a sense. It's a big deal. And in fact, there's a really interesting series of books put out by Princeton University Press called Lives of Great Religious Books. And the first book they chose to do, it's a biography on the Confessions. It's had quite an afterlife. It's been quite a large book. And it's really bequeathed to the West conceptions of the self, of the individual, for better or worse. We're sort of living downstream from Augustine. And while this book is kind of a big deal in that sense, it's not just that. And in fact, I'm not particularly interested in its big dealness. Tonight, I think what is powerful about the Confessions is the way that it tells the story, or better yet, gives the testimony of how someone successfully navigated his own restless years. All the struggles, all the heartache, all the mistakes, all the false starts, all the frantically kicking existential duck legs within him, all the restlessness, it's all there. Augustine has been everywhere you think you need to go. And he's come out on the other side, and he wants to let you know he's found a place of rest for his restlessness. This restlessness is pretty central to the book, and if it's central to a whole kind of season of life, it's a phenomenon that's looking for an explanation. Now, Augustine's restlessness pulled him away from his small village of Thagaste. So this is, if you kind of chart Augustine's life on Google Maps, you get something like this. So Augustine was born here. This is sort of modern-day Algeria. In a place called Thagaste, that's now called Souk Arras, and he could not wait to get out of this small town. From the moment he was born, he was destined for the more sophisticated cultural bright lights of major cities like Rome, where he ended up, as well as Milan. He also studied in Carthage here. So this restlessness drove him away from this town, all the way to these major cities, sort of the ancient equivalents of New York, of London, of D.C., where he ultimately and somewhat reluctantly finds Christ, or he might say was found by Christ, which will result in irony of ironies for him, his return to North Africa. So he starts here, he finds his way up here, this is where he converts, he spends a little bit of time up here, and then he makes his way back here to a place called Hippo, or was called Hippo, now it's called Annaba, just a few miles kind of up the road, and it's another small podunk town. And here, he served the church. He was a priest. He was a bishop for the rest of his life. He wrote sermons. He preached a sermon every day on one of the Psalms for 30 years. He prayed with the sick. He anointed the sick. He composed philosophical and theological treatises that most of his congregants could care less about. And he did so many interesting things. I recently learned that he regularly drew money from the church's treasury to purchase the freedom of slaves. He was sort of an early abolitionist. And once he was out of town and some congregants from his church stormed a slave ship and, like, sacked it and freed almost 100 slaves. So he's kind of an interesting guy. And surrounded by interesting people. But he had this restless heart, this restlessness within him, and it was this engine that drove many of the desires of his life, the desire to get out of Thagaste and to get somewhere more influential, a desire to be seen as intelligent, a desire for sexual prowess, a desire to have a successful career, a desire to have right friends. And it's almost as though, as he narrates the story of his life, each geographical location sort of also represents an existential or spiritual possibility for him, a new place, a new group of people to belong to, a new philosophy to fall into, And in each place, he asks this question, kind of on a gut level, even if he doesn't articulate it. This question is, will you give me rest? Will you bring rest to my restless heart? Will you settle all this unrestlessness in me? Will this new book settle this restlessness? This new relationship, maybe getting married, maybe a new podcast, maybe a new spiritual community. And the answer of will you give me rest was always yes, but not for very long. It never lasted. And so for Augustine to be human is to have this restlessness within us. This is how he opens his confessions kind of famously. He says this, "You are mighty master and to be praised with a powerful voice. Great is your goodness, and of your wisdom there can be no reckoning. In yourself you rouse us, giving us delight in glorifying you because you made us with yourself as our goal, and our heart is restless until it rests in you." So for Augustine to be human is to have this internal restlessness and a desire to find rest somewhere. It's not just that we have it, it's this sense that it should go away. There's some place that we can find relief from this. And he's looking throughout his life to find relief to this restlessness. But the question is why? Why are we restless? Why does our insides kind of feel like frantically kicking duck legs? Why is there this design to us? And one of the ways Augustine answers this, and he does this kind of subtly in the book, is through the story, the parable of the prodigal son. People generally familiar with this story from Luke's gospel, the prodigal son, just looking for some head nods or. But in the parable, a son comes to his father and demands his share of his inheritance early, which is a way of saying, I want you dead. And I want what comes to me when you're dead. And then the son leaves the home and goes off into a distant country where he squanders it. And he ends up broke and far from home and alone, and he has a terrible job where he's eating food that would go to the pigs, and he sort of comes to his senses and realizes, I could work for my dad and do better than this. So reluctantly, he goes home where his father has actually been eagerly awaiting his return, and the father runs out, embarrassing himself, to meet the son and welcomes him back and throws a party. And for Augustine, this is human existence in a nutshell. He's the youngest son. He's the restless runaway who's come to his senses and come home to his loving father. You can see the movements on the map, literally. He runs away from home, and he gets as far away from home as he can, and that's where he comes to faith. And then he returns home. But for Augustine, and in the Confessions, this is not just true about him. It's true about you. It's true about me, and it's true about all creation. So ever the astute philosopher, Augustine picks up on and perhaps reads a little into the Greek of Luke's account of this story. And I think he does so in a powerful way. What the son demands from the father is a share of the property, a share of what's coming to him, his inheritance. And the Greek word is ousia. I demand my ousia. And if you know your church history, if you know your classical philosophy, this is the word for being. This is the word for existence. This is the word for our essence. And so Augustine sees in this parable something that's true about all people, about all of creation, that we have gone to our Father and we have said, I want my existence on my terms and I want it now. We get to decide for ourselves who we are and what we are, what's right and what's wrong. Give me my existence. I wish you were dead. But demanding and grabbing for existence on its own terms, why, it feels really good for a while. In fact, it could feel great for a while. Augustine found that it just leads to this place of restlessness, this frenetic, frantic kicking of little internal duck legs. He's still restless. And so as he tells his story, he tells of all these stops he makes along the way, geographical destinations that are also spiritual and existential possibilities. And again, the question he keeps asking, and he's not always consciously asking this, he's not always explicitly asking this, is, will you give me rest? Will you settle this restlessness within me? And so at this point, I want to turn and walk through the book a little bit more of the book itself. I could never do it justice, not only because we only have so much time together. It's quite, it can be quite a big book. I don't know what I just did there. Oh, look at that. There, you get to see that again.
Oh.
Boom, there he is. Boom, there's the map. But my interest in doing this lecture, I did a lecture on this a few years ago. But what sparked wanting to do it again is that there's been a new translation since then that I think is really beautiful by a woman named Sarah Rudin. She's a classics scholar. I think, Marty, you've read some of her stuff on Paul. It's a fresh translation, and I really liked it, and so I commend it to you. So there's a picture of it there. And then two other books that have been, I found really helpful in helping me make connections between Augustine's life and my own. One is called A Restless Age, How St. Augustine Helps You Make Sense of Your 20s. You can see some parallels already between that book and my title, by a guy named Austin Gone. And then the last one is a new book, yet another new book by James K. A. Smith, On the Road with St. Augustine, A Real World Spirituality for Restless Hearts. So if you're interested in Augustine, these are great for getting more, because there's a whole lot more than I can do. These are great places to start. And what I want to do, as there's all sorts of themes we could trace through the book that are central to Augustine's life. Themes like friendship, things like ambition, sexuality. But what I want to walk through is faith, his relationship to the Christian faith. And sometimes, we're back to Augustine again, sometimes the story or the book is presented as his conversion story. And it's not really his conversion story, because there's multiple conversions along the way. There's lots and lots of stops. But the book begins in his hometown of Thagaste, this small village, and he was raised in something of a mixed Christian home. His mother, Monica, who was the spiritual matriarch of the family, was totally smothering of him, totally controlling, but she was a deeply devout woman of faith. She plays a huge role in his life, in the book. She actually ultimately became a saint in the Catholic Church, and they named a place in California after her, Santa Monica. They gave her some good real estate there. But while Augustine's mom was smothering and very devout and very fervent, Augustine's father was pretty absent from the scene. His name is Patrick. He seems to be much more interested in the 4th century African equivalent of the Patriots game than in his son's life. He's just not a part of the scene at all. And when he is, he's not a good influence on his son. He's a bit of a dud. But Augustine found the local expression of Christianity in his small village to just be completely untenable. He thought it was simplistic. He thought it was superstitious. And so he was only nominally involved in this in his childhood. It lacked philosophical sophistication and cultural credibility. In a word, he was just embarrassed by this. And more or less by his teenage years, he was kind of out. He wasn't really that interested. But he wanted to belong. And he falls in with a bad crowd of rowdy kids that just do trouble for trouble's sake. And they famously steal a pear, or multiple pears, which is why there's a pear on the cover of Rudin's translation. But by the time he's old enough to move out of Thagaste and away from his mother's overbearing presence, he goes to Carthage, which is like a medium-sized city, and there he's going to study. But he officially kind of cuts ties with Christianity, and he joins a Gnostic group called the Manichaeans. If he was on Twitter or Instagram, he would hashtag deconversion here as he was recounting it to whoever would be following Augustine on Twitter in the 4th century. But a Gnostic group, if people aren't familiar with Gnosticism, there's a cluster of religious communities and beliefs. It's not one monolithic thing, but central to many of them is this idea of having knowledge. Gnosis means knowledge. Gnosis, Gnostic. So it's about having special knowledge. And what I think what matters about his sojourn with these Manichaeans was not so much what they believed, but how they went about believing. You would probably giggle if you read the actual substance of the Manichaeans. It reads like myths from Star Wars. And I'm not even talking about like the original kind of cool Star Wars trilogy. I'm talking about the prequels or fan fiction. It's really bizarre, fantastical stuff. To us, it sounds really superstitious. But it was their way of believing that drew Augustine. What they promised Augustine. James K.A. Smith, in the book On the Road with St. Augustine, refers to the Manichaeans as the rationalists of their day. They prided themselves on having escaped all the superstitious and embarrassing aspects of most religious communities. And instead, they had a firm foundation to their knowledge, this gnosis. Their belief was based on the course of the sun, the moon, and the stars, not on silly things like prophets, spirits, or sacred books. So again, I think what matters here was what drew him in, how they went about believing, not so much what they believed. And I think this appeal or this marketing strategy is still very much alive today in many ways. It's a contemporary option for people considering deconversion. It's this alluring promise of a sophisticated certainty that your parents' faith just doesn't have. It's this epistemological positivity. Having a direct knowledge to the way things actually are, and so that you can unlock all the mysteries of the world and make sense of things. So whether it's things like behavioral economics or neuroscience, things that I think are actually really cool and kind of interesting, but can have the propensity to be kind of all-explaining, totalizing discourses, or things like new atheism, there are many live ways into sort of explaining reality with complete certainty. And this is what drew Augustine in, and he spends the better part of 9 years with this group of people. It was this allure of certain knowledge as a way to give his restless heart rest that brought him in, but it's also what slowly drew him out of this group. It was the Manichaeans' inability to help him wrestle with his questions that over time dampened his initial enthusiasm. He was a very excited convert to this group. And over time, he had questions, and he found that their answers were kind of weak, or they had the strategy of saying, wait for Faustus. There's this guy, this Manichaean guru of sorts. Wait for Faustus. Faustus will explain everything. Faustus will give you the answer. Just wait for Faustus. And when he finally meets Faustus, Faustus turns out to kind of be like the Gilderoy Lockhart of the Manichaeans. He's great on paper and in reputation, but you meet him in person and he's a total dud. He's like a hipster pastor who's got great sneakers and really cool glasses, but sort of lacks substance. And Augustine says this about him. Augustine says, when he did come, I found him a pleasant, well-spoken man, who nattered on more agreeably than the others, but on the same subjects. Yet what good was the handsomest of waiters when I was thirsty for costlier vintages? He doesn't just want a good, he's full of all these little, like, clever images, I think, throughout it. He wants something of substance, and he gets answers that just aren't helpful, and he's crushed. He's disappointed by this. He's been sold a bill of certainty, but it doesn't deliver. And so while he deconverted from what he saw as a simplistic Christianity of his parents to this Manichaeanism, this rationalist of the day, he deconverts from them again. He doesn't want a cool pastor or a handsome waiter. He wants something of substance to help settle his restless heart. And even though he left, in some sense, the Manichaeans on an intellectual and spiritual level, he still spent most of his time with them. He wanted to belong somewhere, and they were pretty good to him. They helped get him a job. They looked out for him. They provided his social needs. Belief and belonging are intertwining realities all throughout Augustine's confessions, and I think throughout many people's lives as well. But he leaves the Manichaeans, and he dabbles a little bit in astrology. But he has this strong religious rebound of sorts. He goes from a place of religious certainty with the Manichaeans. He joins another group called the Academics. And the Academics, in Augustine's words, they determined that no part of the truth could be grasped by humankind. This was an ancient version of agnosticism. We can't actually know anything. So when unshakable certainty was shaken, he found refuge and comfort in the power of pervasive doubt. Augustine was really honest during this period. He spent most of his time with his Manichaean friends, but he just didn't really, his heart and his mind weren't there. He'd already moved along. And so he's trying to live in this tension between certainty and doubt, as well as the pull of different religious communities. And he was honestly coming apart. He was having a hard time. And then comes another conversion of sorts. Not yet to the Christian faith, not yet at least, but kind of to the hot philosophy of the day, Neoplatonism. So we've got another movement into another religious community. It's an elaborate, sophisticated metaphysical system that privileges non-material things over material things. And at this point, Augustine is living in Milan, and he's a teacher of rhetoric, and he is trying to move up the social ladder. And spending time with Neoplatonists is kind of helps him, because it's the hot philosophy of the day. But that said, he also found himself sitting in the back pew of a cathedral in Milan, listening to a preacher named Ambrose, who presented the same Orthodox Christian faith that he heard as a child in Thagaste, but in a noticeably different way. His mother's faith came across to him as superstitious and simplistic, and in some ways it probably very much was. Ambrose was a rhetorical powerhouse, and he was a force to be reckoned with intellectually. And he avoided simplistic answers that Augustine's childhood faith perpetuated. And Ambrose really took Augustine under his wing and took him very seriously. Augustine spoke of him as becoming a father to him of sorts. And they worked through all sorts of issues. And so while he wasn't convinced totally of the plausibility of the Christian faith, it got some street cred to him in light of Ambrose's teaching. Before going on, though, to speak of his final deconversion away from Neoplatonism and his conversion into the Christian faith, it's worth saying, I think that most likely many of you probably haven't, or most likely never will, run into a Manichaean. You probably know a lot of smart people online or in real life who are agnostic, but they're probably not card-carrying members of the academics. And while Neoplatonism was a hot thing in Augustine's day, it's probably not a live religious option or philosophical option for many of us here. But that aside, can you relate at all to Augustine's story, living in between these larger cultural and spiritual pressures of certainty, of doubt, of believing and belonging, of faith and reason, of disappointment with spiritual leaders, as well as being helped by people further along in a spiritual community? There are a lot of narratives of deconversion right now going on. They're kind of all the rage, and they're people who are struggling to live with these pressures, how to make sense of them. Sometimes they're triumphant. I've left behind the naive, simplistic faith of the church in Thagaste, and I'm on to like better things. I don't need that stuff. And sometimes they're more humble. They're more sad. They're even despondent about how difficult it is to leave behind systems of meaning, as well as the communities that were part of that. So I think like many people today, whether it's you or people you know, trying to make an honest way through a moment where there's a lot of existential and spiritual options, the path for Augustine was not linear. It wasn't direct, it wasn't easy, and it came with a lot of heartache. And so in this way, I think Augustine's day feels so much like our own day. In fact, I think it feels more like our day than our grandparents' day feels like Augustine's day. There's more in common now. We live in a moment that philosopher Charles Taylor calls a secular age. And by that, he means many, many things. But central is that there's no longer default answers. Nothing is indubitable. Nothing is axiomatic. Everything is up for grabs. And this places a lot of pressure on people. From all sorts of directions, from faith, from doubt, from different communities. And all of this pressure creates what Taylor calls a spiritual supernova over the last 40 years. there's been an explosion of new options and possibilities for people to make sense of their lives. It's not just one way anymore, or maybe two or three ways. There's countless ways. There's always a new podcast. There's always a new book. There's always a newly discovered ancient spiritual practice. There's always a new speaking tour. There's always a new intentional community. I'm not trying to say those are all bad things, because many of those are really good things. But some of them can be Faustuses, in a sense. They can be handsome waiters that serve you cheap wine. And on Taylor's read, this spiritual supernova has led to what he calls a multitude of third ways. Choose your own adventure, cafeteria-style spirituality. People have always been living with difficult questions and with certain pressures, but in our moment, like Augustine's moment, there's not a default answer. There's not one assumed path. We can look from place to place to place, asking whether or not these places and these options will give our hearts rest. And the moral imperative, the moral impulse today, is to do this ourselves. In the past, you might have asked a priest or a guidance counselor or your grandparents, but chances are today, you don't really ask anybody. And if you do ask anybody, you ask Siri, or you ask Alexa, and you figure it out yourself with the help of the internet. And so in an age where the air we breathe is individualism, these spiritual third ways feel really natural. They feel right, they feel good, they feel authentic. We should make sense of our own way, ourselves, on our own terms. This is sort of the air we breathe. And it's difficult. This can feel good in a lot of ways because you can choose what you want. But a difficulty with living in this sort of pluralized secular culture with endless options for third ways is we become paralyzed by the amount of choices that are presented to us and the haunting reality that we chose the wrong way. It's the sort of feeling when you go to a restaurant and there is a massive menu and you order something, but then someone else's food comes out and you think, I should have ordered that. Why did I order chicken Caesar salad? when the burgers look so good tonight. And I wonder if that's in part some of the explanation around religious nuns. It's just easier not to choose, right? It's easier to skip a meal than to sometimes deal with the regret or the haunting fear of choosing the wrong way. But a restless heart is a hungry heart, and not eating can only work for so long. I'm kind of sticking with this metaphor a little bit. Not only might you get food envy or lose your appetite, you might never eat your greens. With these intuitive choose-your-own-way, third-way spiritualities, there's often no need to hear something you don't already agree with or you don't want to hear, or to hear an idea that's culturally unacceptable or personally offensive. You don't like how it tastes. You don't eat it. No broccoli for me. I don't have to believe in this. And so on this read, the things that are external to us, religious traditions, religious communities, spiritual practices, beliefs, institutions, they only matter because we want them to matter in a certain way. Their significance is whatever significance we put on them. But avoiding cooked vegetables and your leafy greens, maybe the embarrassing, culturally irrelevant teachings, can lead to a place of unhealth in many ways, not only leaving you not strong enough to deal with the pressures and the difficulties of living in a hard world, but what about the difficulties of living with yourself? Where might we go when our personally curated spiritualities lead us to places of regret and despair and self-hatred? This is where Augustine is, right before his conversion. And interestingly enough, what's happened between his last conversion and this one is he's become intellectually convinced of the Christian faith. He thinks it's true. He sat long enough in the back row with Ambrose. It makes sense to him. But while he's convinced of the legitimacy of the Christian faith, he's not at all convinced about himself. He wants to be a Christian. But his problem is him. This prodigal son on his journey into the distant country has picked up some bad habits that he can't shake. And if you know anything about Augustine, you can probably guess what they revolve around. They revolve around sex. Augustine had had something of a monogamous girlfriend relationship for a long time, but she was from a lower class than him. And so overbearing Monica, Saint Monica, said this cannot last. And in fact, Augustine and this relation, this woman, had actually had a child together. But Monica said, you can't get married. She's from a lower class. If you want to keep moving up the social ladder, you've got to marry someone else. So he sends her away. It's a very painful part of the book. He loved her in many ways. But he listens to his mom in this one. It's a disappointing moment for Augustine, to say the least. But she leaves, and Augustine is heartbroken. And she leaves, and he kind of goes off the rails. He lives it up. He goes to Vegas, so to say. But what happens in Vegas doesn't stay in Vegas. That idea that the sins we engage with sort of just stay over there and don't come with us is an illusion. He's a different person. And he finds himself powerless to change behavior that he hates, that he habitually engages in. He's at the mercy of his own sex drive, and he describes it as both enslaving and kind of puts him to sleep. So I'm going to read two different ways he kind of speaks about this. This first one, I feel like kind of he's anticipating contemporary discussions on addiction. The individual choices over time create these grooves that we naturally run in, and then they become the default way that we go about things. They become a necessity. But he says this, "But I was bound not by anybody else's irons, but by my own iron will. The enemy possessed my wanting, and from it he had constructed a chain for me and constricted me in it. Inordinate desire arises from a twisting of the will, and in the course of slavery to this desire, habit forms. And through lack of resistance to this desire, a certain inevitability emerges. With these links, as it were, interconnected, and that's why I've called this a chain, a harsh slavery held me tightly in check." And then he speaks about how it also has put him to sleep, so to say. He says, there's no one who'd like to sleep forever. And everyone with unimpaired judgment prefers being awake. Yet a person still generally puts off rousing himself while a heavy sluggishness lingers in his body. And he'd rather grasp at dozing, though by now he disapproves of it, in spite of it being time to get up. He said, "I had no answer to say to you when you said, 'Awake, O sleeper. Rise and let Christ shine on you.' All around me you demonstrated to me that what you were saying was true, but I had no kind of answer for you at all, except a few slow-witted and slow-waking words. 'In a minute, I'll get up in a minute. Let me alone a little bit while.' But that minute was hardly a minute, and that little while went on longer and longer." So he feels stuck. This path of following himself that should have been freedom has led him to a place where he's enslaved, and he can't get out of bed, even though he wants to get out of bed. His problem isn't knowing what to do. He knows what he should do. The difficulty is putting it into action. How do you get to the place you know you need to be? How do you conjure up the strength on your own? But it's not just that his bad habits have enslaved him and put him to sleep. He mocks himself. His own internal voices condemn him, telling him he's a piece of trash. They damn him. They say this to him. They kind of taunt him. They say things to him like, "Are you really going to show us the door? The moment that you do that, and for all time, you won't have us around anymore." They say other things to him too, and they end by saying, "Do you imagine you could actually be happy without us? That you could make it without us?" And so he believes what he's telling himself. He condemns himself that he's stuck here. This is who he is. But he's brought himself here. Kind of reminds me of AA saying, "Your best thinking brought you here." But what it takes to get him out of here is a louder voice that's outside of his self. It's not just him. It's not just what he's chosen on the menu for himself. And he has what's a little bizarre in some ways, so stick with it, but he has a vision. And I want to read to you the vision that he has. So these voices, his own voices, are mocking him. And he says this, "But at that moment, when they were saying this to me with utter lukewarmth, there appeared from the direction where I turned my face, but trembled to traverse, self-restraint. She was calm and not lax in her lightheartedness. She honorably sweet-talked me, telling me to come and not delay. And she extended reverent arms to lift me up and embrace me. She already held whole flocks of people who could teach me by example. No end of small boys and young girls were there, and many people in early adulthood. But every age was represented, including serious-minded widows and elderly virgins. And among all these people, self-restraint was anything but barren. She was a fruitful mother whose sons were joys begotten from you, Master, her lawful husband. She laughed at me, but it was an encouraging laughter, suggesting the question, you won't be able to do what all these mere people have done. Do you really think they achieved it through themselves and not through God? God gave them to me. Why are you trying to stand on your own so that you fail to stand? Throw yourself forward onto him. Don't be afraid. He won't back away and let you fall. Fling yourself forward and don't worry about it. He'll catch you. He'll take you up under his care, and he will heal you." And so at this point, it's a little unusual vision, but he sees this vision of Lady Self-Restraint, Lady Wholeness. He's lived a life where he's decided what he wants to do, and he's found himself an enchained, sleepy, and scattered person. And he sees this vision of a whole life, of a different way of life, of simple people. In this cloud of witnesses, there's no celebrity pastors. There's no Faustuses. It's a bunch of nobodies. And it says, "Have you come to the end of yourself? Because this is where you begin. This is where grace comes in. Blessed are those who are poor in spirit. Why are you relying on yourself and your restless heart when you know that you're just unreliable? He's been looking for rest in all the wrong places. In certainty, in doubt, in success, in sex, ultimately just in himself. And so much of this reminds me of the modern impulse to just accumulate spiritual experiences for ourselves. But Augustine realizes that in doing so, he scattered himself. And he wants to be a whole person. And so, at this stage, Augustine converts. Kind of famously, if you've heard anything about him or seen lots of photos, he runs to a garden where he's weeping and crying uncontrollably. And he hears these children off in the distance sing, tole lege, which means take and read. And he happens to have stumbled across a book, and he picks it up and reads it. And it's Romans. And he reads Romans. And it says, to put on Christ and to make no provision for the flesh. And he converts. And we all know converts. We all know the enthusiasm that comes with conversion. Right? It settles all the problems. Everything is fine. I'm not where I once was. Everything is great. It's smooth sailing. And this is not just people who convert into Christianity, but it's often true of people who convert out of Christianity as well. But Augustine's story doesn't end there. It doesn't end with the conversion, and I love him for this. He says this. This is later. This is years later. He's written this years after this. He says this, "I took too long to fall in love with you. Beauty so ancient and so new. I took too long to fall in love with you. But there you were inside, and I was outside, and there I searched for you. And into those shapely things you made, my misshapen self went sliding. You were with me, but I wasn't with you. Those things which wouldn't exist unless they existed in you held me back far from me, far from you. You called and shouted and shattered my deafness. You flashed, you shone, and you put my blindness to flight. You smelled sweet and I drew breath, and now I pant for you. I tasted you and now I'm starving and parched. You touched me and I burst into flame with desire for your peace. But he says, but I'm still not full of you. And in fact, I'm a dead weight to myself. And he goes on from this moment forward, this beautiful, beautiful description of encountering God. And he has a laundry list of his struggles, a laundry list of his daily, daily struggles. He says, I struggle every day. And he shows us, I think, I love this about him, that redeemed hearts are still prone to wander, even if they've tasted rest. And these are some of the things he admits to struggling with. He's painfully honest. How his early ambition for a successful career has just migrated from sort of a secular occupation to his life in the church. He's honest about his struggles with wet dreams. He's honest about his struggle about drinking too much wine, about eating too much rich food, about getting carried away listening to really moving, beautiful music. One of his early struggles that I didn't talk about was he would go to the theater and just get so carried away in his own emotions. Emotions are a big thing here for Augustine, really all throughout his life. But he also says, I really struggle to pray. I get super distracted when I pray. I start praying and then I'm just like all over the place. Conversion is not a kind of catch-all solution. It didn't pluck Augustine up out of life, but it did give him a direction on where to go, on where he can find rest. James K.A. Smith says, to know where you're headed is not a promise of smooth sailing. And I like that about Augustine. And so I think the power of his story is different than the power of many other stories, people's biographies, autobiographies. Whether we hear them or watch them or read them, what captivates us is how these people are different than us, how they're distinct from us, how they go to places we're never going to go ourselves, whether it's great halls of power or performing in front of thousands of adoring fans or overcoming some insurmountable obstacle. We read them in order to learn more about them and their unique experience, their gifting, their great accomplishments. In a nutshell, what makes them different than us? And it's understandable to sort of approach the confessions that way. As I said in the beginning, Augustine's kind of a big deal in Western culture. But I think this misses how to read what the confessions is about. And Jamie Smith says, a better way to read this would be to read it more as a recovery story, not a story of some great life, but a recovery story, the type of story you hear in a church basement at an AA meeting, right? Not something recounted in some larger-than-life Hollywood biopic. He says recovery stories function differently. They don't say, hey, look at me, look at how unique I am, look at all this cool stuff that you're never going to get to do. Instead, they say, look, you think you're alone in your shame? You think you're alone in your mistakes and your sins? I've been there, too. I've walked that road. I know what it feels like, and I know where it's leading. The power of recovery stories is that they're common. In fact, they're kind of generic. They all sound the same. Because part of their purpose is not to provoke awe and wonder. Part of their purpose is for you to imagine yourself in the same sort of story. Other people have lived this story, and you can live this story too. The confessions aren't asking you, what do you think of Augustine? Do you think he's really cool? Do you think he's really smart? They're asking you, what do you know about yourself? What's possible for you? And where are you looking to find rest? He's writing not to tell you about himself, though he clearly is. He's telling you more about himself than most people will tell you. But he's writing to tell you about you. And his tone is not pandering or patronizing, a sort of been there, done that dismissiveness. He's not concerned about staying relevant and hip and having cool sneakers and sunglasses or sharing war stories. He wants to help you in a journey, but he is still very much on himself. So I started this lecture with an image of a duck, smooth above the water, on top of the water. And I want to end this lecture with an image of a shark. Now, not all of us are emerging adults. Augustine wasn't at the time of writing the Confessions. He was 43. He'd been baptized for 10 years. He'd been a priest for 6 years. And he'd been a bishop for less than 1 year. He was an adult. He'd arrived. And perhaps you're not in your restless years, but you might be haunted by mistakes you made in your restless years. You might still be, like Augustine, carrying these prodigal habits with you. They can haunt you, and they can stalk you. Their power is that, part of their power is our fear of them. These memories we have, these mistakes we made, the shame that we carry. Now, I recently read of an interview with one of the cameramen who works on Shark Week. And he was asked, how can you do this? How can you do this? Aren't you so afraid of the shark? And he said, of course I'm afraid of the shark. But my strategy is, instead of swimming away from the shark, I counterintuitively swim towards the shark. The shark expects everything to swim away from it. That's the shark's power. It's the biggest fish in the sea, and nothing swims at it. So if you swim towards it, it's like, wait, what are you doing? And then it leaps. That's its power. Its power, in a sense, is it's the fear that it instills in you. And shame's power and haunting memory's power is often derived by our flight from it. But the more we run, the more it pursues us. And so what Augustine is doing in this book, that some people say is the first autobiography in the Western tradition, he's not just telling his story. If you remember, I read the opening line where he says, "Great are you, Lord, and greatly to be praised." He's praying through his haunting, shark-like memories, the things that haunt him, the things he's trying to get away from, but he's bringing them into the presence of God. The book is really an extended healing prayer session. He faces his shark, and he faces his shark with the help of Jesus. And that's where I'm going to end. And what we do here is we have a time of question and response. So you're free to go, free to get another cookie if there's another cookie, or if there are more cookies. But we'll stay and chat about Augustine, about restless years, anything you want to talk about. So the floor is open.
Thank you. Do we have any clue? You mentioned he's 43 when he wrote the Confessions.
Yeah.
Of ages along the way?
Yes. Yeah. There's different ages. So.
So what?
I have them elsewhere written down. But yeah, the longest period of time he spends anywhere is with the Manichaeans, which is about 9 years. What's that?
Is that in Milan?
It starts in Thagaste and then goes up into Milan.
I see.
And then in Milan, he's a teacher of rhetoric, and so that's probably his late 20s, early 30s. Yeah. So, and then, yeah, that's the longest period of time he spends sort of in one group, but I don't know him off the top of my head, his years, but yeah. But it's definitely, I mean, he's out of the house, I think, when he's like 16, is when he goes to, goes to Carthage, 16 or 17. I could be wrong on that. Any Augustine scholars? No? No? Okay. Yeah. Yeah, Marty?
The comment you made in the beginning about research that's been done on the adolescent brain.
Yeah.
Actually, Dick and I were just talking about this evening at home, because saying that more and more of the evidence shows that adolescents, they're incapable of making wise judgments because of the development of the brain or something like that. That's kind of the caricature. But then I was thinking, you know, there's been so much research on the feedback loop between biology and behavior and culture, and the fact that the brain is actually much more plastic than we used to think, which makes me wonder, these are statements of this is the way it is. Adolescents, you know, we can't expect them to be to make mature decisions because their brains are like this. But I wonder how much of that is because of this feedback, the cultural feedback loop, because people at much younger ages carry way more responsibility in earlier times than they are in our culture.
Yeah.
But my other thought there was that one of the things that's really intrigued me about the Bible, the Old Testament, it doesn't talk about this in the New Testament, is that the age, there are several places, three or four places, which talk about an age of accountability, of moral accountability is 20. And the only people who were allowed into the Promised Land after rebelling against God over and over and over again were the two spies, Joshua, Caleb, who was the other spy? I forget. What was it, Joshua? Just Joshua and Caleb?
Yep.
Well, anyway, the spies who went in and spied out the land, who were obedient, and the little ones, they're described as the little ones who do not yet know their right hand from their left, and they were the under 20-year-olds. So everybody under 20 were not held accountable for the sins of the Israelites in the wilderness. They were allowed into the land. And then also it was 20, or at 20, young men had to serve in the military. Before that, they didn't. So I just think it's intriguing wonder that there seems to be some sense there from God's perspective, at least for ancient Israelites, that before you were 20, you weren't held as accountable morally.
Yeah.
I don't know. And then how that goes to the brain science, I don't know.
Yeah. Anybody want to jump on that anyway? We've been reading Jonah, and that right hand from the left, that's what they have, the people of Nineveh are described.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that. Yeah. Anybody? Ben?
Is there I've heard by people that know about the confessions that it's unique, not just in that it's an autobiography, but it's almost modern in its psychological understanding of what's going on. It's very, maybe modern is the wrong word, but very relevant psychologically. I'm just wondering, is there anything written about how he came to write them the way he did? Did he intend it to be read by lots of people? Was it something that was just a reflection that he was going to carry on with himself? I'm just curious.
So he says, he kind of says more or less like that thing that Smith says about a recovery story, if I can find it. So he was a relatively new bishop. And people were he's in a small town. He's like in a backwater. And people are like, this guy's from Milan, and this guy's from Rome, and he was a Neoplatonist and a man. Like, people are like, but he writes, he says that, I mean, he basically writes, it's a bit of a longer, people wanted to hear. He says, so what business do I have with other people, letting them hear my testimony as if they were going to cure all my ills? Humankind is quite inquisitive about someone else's life, but quite lazy about correcting their own. Why do they ask to hear from me who I am when they don't want to hear from you who they are? And how do they know when they're hearing both about me, and from me, whether I'm telling the truth? In fact, no one on earth knows what's going on in anyone, unless the spirit within them knows, which is he's quoting Paul there. He says, if in contrast people hear from you about themselves, they can't say that you're lying. What's self-knowledge after all, but hearing from you about themselves? Who then has this knowledge yet and says it's wrong unless he's lying? But since selfless love believes all things, at least among those it binds to itself and thus unifies. Sorry, he's sort of quoting. He's always quoting scripture, and sometimes it just confuses me. Mm-hmm. But he says, I too, Master, will join in testifying to you in such a way that other people can hear me at the same time. And then he's going on to say, well, when the confessions of my past wrongdoings, which you forgave and hid, so that you could make me happy in yourself. That's like a big theme in this part of happiness is joy in the truth. That's how he describes it. That's his definition of it. He says everyone wants to be happy. He said, you forgave so that you can make me happy in yourself. Changing my soul with faith and your rite and baptism are read and heard. They arouse the heart out of its sleep of despair in which it says, I can't. It then lies awake in its passions for your mercy and the sweetness of your grace. So he says, basically, he wants people to hear his story and think, oh, like, well, okay, like, one, okay, this is who this guy is. But also, like, I could do this too. Like, he wants his story and to be that. And so it was released kind of like in episodes. Mm-hmm. So if you get it, it says, you know, book one. And then, you know, book two, because it came out kind of like in episodes. And it was, by the end, it was a bestseller, because people wanted to know about this guy. But so his motivation was, one, to sort of let people know who he was, but then also to sort of inspire them, to call them into a different sort of life. And
there's something you said, it's basically like a testimony to God that other people can hear.
Yeah. And so that they, for if they say, I can't, they can look to him and say, I can.
Do you remember when you were talking about him with the Manichaeans and that he was drawn in by, did you say by how they believed?
Yeah, how they believed. Yeah, the manner in which they believed.
Can you say more about that? Because you were also saying there can be a similar draw today.
Yeah, so what they promised was certainty.
Like, that was mostly about the certainty.
It was what they believed. They were kind of the rationalists. They didn't believe, you hear what they actually believe in, and it just sounds crazy. It's like the, it's like the backstory to Scientology. You hear it, you're like, what is this stuff? Planets and, but for them, how they went about knowing, it's not so much like what they knew. I mean, what they believed is also important, but just for, kind of, I thought about how to do it. It's like he was drawn to them because they offered certainty, and it had this air of sophistication, the sort of backwater Christianity that he knew felt like kind of like just sort of like, oh, just have faith. Like, so yeah, that was is yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Or yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm curious. Thank you so much for this. That was great. Was there anything in the James K.A. Smith about like connecting it with James Fowler's Stages of Faith? If you're familiar with that, it talks about like how it's an idea that was developed I think in the 60s about how we potentially develop through stages of faith. It tends to be a little bit linear, which people have been like pushed back, especially in the last like 10 years on emerging adulthood. Being like this phase to get through, and that like adulthood is like the culmination of it, and that like the achievement of adulthood is like this thing to strive for. So I'm curious, like, how does he deal with the like news of adulthood? It whether it's Augustine or Smith, like, does Augustine see it as just like achievement, or is it more like it sounds like it's a little bit less linear?
Yeah, so I named this lecture a long time ago, with some of that like emerging, and so I read this other book, which is a good read, The A Restless Age, which I don't think he interacts with Fowler, but I don't think Augustine thought of human development in sort of the neat, tidy, or through, or sorry, like kind of through those sort of stages that we do. But what he is doing is reflecting on the years that sort of coincide more or less with this age, or with this stage that we're talking about emerging adulthood. And he sort of diagnoses one of our main problems as restlessness, which, I mean, you can see there's like a restlessness in people that we diagnose in different ways. But yeah, so that book doesn't ring a bell. But again, Augustine, I'm trying to think, it's more of something I've put back on him, sort of, as opposed to something that like he's working with that I can think of. I could be wrong. Does that make sense? Or
yeah. No, I think it's actually encouraging that it's not like that adulthood isn't like this. Like his aim isn't achievement, it's rest.
Yeah. I mean, he's there's just a lot of things he weaves through the book. It's interesting. I have this little stack of books to impress. Impressionable, but it's pretty impressive. I carried it over here, but I haven't read all of it. But I actually carried it. But one of these books, this is a book. It's called A Reader's Companion to Augustine's Confessions by Kim Paffenroth and Robert Kennedy, and there's 13 chapters or books in the Confessions. Mm-hmm. And there's 13 chapters here, and each chapter is arguing why that book or that chapter is the way in to sort of like understanding the book. And like that it all hinges on book 7. Actually, no, it all hinges on. And it's by 13 different theologians or scholars. It's a really interesting read in some way. I haven't read all of it just because it also just gets... Some of the confessions are pretty, I find very lively and exciting. Some of it I think is pretty dry and abstract, and just sort of dizzying. But so even like looking at that, like there's just so many different ways that seem to also, like it's a very rich book. And I've read it in two different translations and then, sections in other translations, and there's just so many things going on that he's doing, so it's not like he's just looking at sort of like faith development or dealing with from emerging adulthood into adulthood. He's like kind of doing all these very different things. It's sort of when I read, and I don't do it often, when I read theologians from pre-medieval. Or even, not that I read a lot, but it's like when I think of like, okay, this person is a theologian, this person is writing pastoral care, this person is doing biblical studies, this person is doing sort of psychological development, and like they're kind of neat things. And Augustine is like doing all of those things in one sentence, like blurring all categories. Like he's reflecting on scripture and talking about your spiritual life and sort of being a pastor. Like it's just all kind of mixed, and sometimes it works. Other times it's just like, what is happening here? They just don't work. I don't know. I'm sort of rambling. Does that make any sense? So, and I see that in some other early Christian authors as well. And, I don't know. Something about that I really like. It's very integrative to me. And there's some contemporary, right? We were talking about Ellen Davis. I think Ellen Davis is a scholar who can do some of those things too. Yeah, and they're just, yeah, so, yeah, you know.
So, in my reading of Confessions, the understanding that faith is a gift is very central and common theme. So, I was wondering if you could share your insights with us on how our receptivity to that gift or living it out is in connection with, like, how we're feeling in particular moments in our wandering versus being settled in God and accepting that gift?
Yeah, so the question is, great, like You said grace is a gift? You said, or faith is?
Yeah, Augustine always says, like, faith is a gift.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, one of the common refrains in the book that he is just like, he throws out all the time is like, what do we have that we have not been given, or what that we have not received? Like, he's quoting a line from Paul in 1 Corinthians-ish in the New Testament somewhere. And so, yeah, that's really central for him, I think. But I think for him, faith, this gift, is also, and maybe some of this is my reading of Augustine has been, I listened to Jamie Smith like 10 years ago teach on the Confessions. And so some of that still is ringing in my, so sometimes I'm like, maybe I'm just hearing Augustine through too much through this lens. But I think some of it works. But yeah, it's like, it's a gift, but like, Augustine is, what weighs him down and makes him think it's impossible to become a Christian are these bad habits that, like, you know, that like chain him down, that cause him to be asleep, and that condemn him. And then he talks about, he has this vision, he comes to faith, but those bad habits are still like with him. So he has like a taste of rest and a direction on where he's going to find like a stillness for his heart. But he's very much like a realist in the sense that like those habits don't just like, they don't just disappear. And so part of how faith is a gift is the Spirit also wants to sort of rehabituate us. Like we run in sort of different rhythms, different patterns, different ways. Which I think sort of sounds like, sometimes I'm like, does this sound more like Jamie Smith, or does this sound like, does this sound like Augustine? But it seems like that's so much of what he's trying to do in Book 10, where like the center of Book 10 is this idea of the happy life, which is joy and truth. And he sort of begins the book by listing kind of virtues that he's working for. At the second half of the book, he's listing all these vices that are still a part of his life. And he's trying to find joy. Happiness is kind of realizing who he is before God, and that by himself, he's never going to deal with all of these problems, and he's never going to become all of these virtues. But he's trying to open himself up and move towards those virtues and move away from those vices. Anyway, did that make any sense? I feel like I'm rambling a little bit, and I'm not even sure what I'm saying.
No, if you want to know the truth. It was just more of an inquiry into your reflections on faith and how being restless, or this juxtapositioning between God's redemption and us building these new habits and falling back into old ways, how those kind of coalesce together in our receptivity to the gift of faith. So yes, that was great.
Okay. All right. I'm going to still think about it, because I felt like I want to say more, but I'm trying to grasp at what. Yeah. Marty?
I have some quick questions just about his life.
Yeah.
He had a son by his common law life.
A doteus.
And, I mean, did he ever sort of repent of how he treated his the woman?
I think he hated the fact that he did it. He's not happy. When he's writing it, it's not a happy moment,
right.
And it's not a prideful. It's not something he's proud of, in any stretch or any. It's interesting. He's sometimes critiqued because she's never named, and there's a couple of different thoughts. Like one, some of the like the most moving prose or like writing in the book. He has a close friend that dies. His friend almost dies, and when he's almost dead, there's some weird baptism theology in Augustine. But his friend almost dies, and then when he's like on his deathbed, they baptize him, and he comes back. And Augustine's like kind of joking with him, like, "Oh, you know, I got baptized, but you know, now we're going to go back to our old way." And he's like, "No, I'm a Christian now. Like, I got baptized. This is serious." And then he dies. He actually dies. And then Augustine has this amazing, I mean, just pages of kind of pouring out his sadness in this really beautiful prose. But he never names the friend. He like never gives the friend's name. For some reason, he doesn't say who the friend is. So her not being named, one theory is just he has reasons for not naming certain people that are very close to him, and it's not to dismiss her. The other is that some people think she actually lived in North Africa, and she became a Christian and then lived her days in virginity, like, or in purity after that. She wasn't a virgin because she was a mother. It's a crazy story. We can talk about some of that later, off mic if need be. But, he speaks of her so highly. It is a hard moment in the book, I think. I'm not living in that world. I don't understand status and all the marriage and stuff. But I do sort of, I can imagine an overbearing mother. And part of me is just like, oh, dude, like, I don't know. So he has a son. They actually got baptized at the same time together. And they lived in a Christian community together in North, like,
The mother and the son did?
No, Augustine and the son. They lived up here. It was called Cassiconium. It's now called, however you say. Yeah, yeah. But he died. He died. He died young. I think when he was like 10. That was a hard thing. But
did he ever marry?
He never married. He never married yet. And in fact, I think because sex was such a difficulty for him, his sort of writing on sex and marriage afterwards is a mixed bag.
Yeah.
And I think some of that is he still has his own hang-ups. He's written so much. He's someone who you measure his output like in like feet. Like Augustine has wrote like 6 feet of book. Or books. Like, it's not like he's written 6 books. There's just so much stuff.
Yeah.
And some of it, you know, he has at least, that I know of, at least 4 different readings of Genesis 1 to 3. And he's intentionally doing different things in each read. So there's just like so much. But even sometimes where he talks about like pre-fallen sex is there's like, almost like no lust and there's like no desire. It's almost
only
like
for procreation.
Sterile and procreation. But then late in other places, he says really, really different things about marriage. He talks about the 3 goods of marriage, and calls it, one of them is companionship, one is children, and one is this like Paul's language of that it's a mystery. So that he uses the language marriage is a sacrament. So it's like a good thing. He's really interesting. He's interesting in that way. And it's when he has the vision with Lady Self-Restraint, or sometimes Lady Continence, he talks about many elderly, or he says many older virgins, I think. And it was interesting to read about that because, Christianity, at least what I read, and I could be wrong, I might be making this statement to the wrong person, who knows otherwise, but, one of the understandings was that like Christianity allowed women the dignity to do what they want with their bodies, where in the wider Roman culture they did not have that. And so for a woman to say, I'm a virgin, is not just to sort of like, sex is dirty, I want to renounce sex, I want to be a, you know, like there is some of that, I'm sure. But some of it is like, look, this is a woman who got to do what she wanted to do with her body. It's almost like proto-women's rights in some way, that she can do what she wants, and she's not just a satellite for some man. Her dignity comes in what she does. So, and I think Augustine especially admires women like that, because he's like, I know, I didn't do that. Like, that wasn't me. But, so, and another thing, Jamie Smith in his book has a chapter on sex in Augustine, and I think he sums it up very well. He says sometimes Augustine wasn't truly Augustinian in his view of sex. And he was full of some confusion. And part of that, I think, I don't know if he says it But part of that is probably from his hang-ups, his own background, which is, you know, this is why we need women theologians and why we need other people than just Augustine to talk about these things. Exactly. Even though I think he has some helpful things to say, and it's actually quite a, yeah, it's a really interesting, that chapter in that book is interesting. But Sarah and I took a class in grad school that was on, it's not a lot of things, but a lot of the class structured around Augustine's view of the three goods of marriage. And it definitely made me not want to get married for a while. But then it made me want to get married. It took me a while to sort of come around to it. And,
refer to it as the class that broke us up, but got us back together.
Yeah. So, and I think Augustine likes our marriage. I think he's cool with it. Anyway.
Doesn't matter in the end, you know?
Oh, well, Augustine. Oh, yeah. No, I'm not staying up late. Yeah. I'm not worried about what he.
All that time with the Manichaeans and the Neoplatonists was not.
Out. Yeah. No. Totally. And for sure. Yeah, because it's interesting. Because so it's like Neoplatonism. Like he talks about Neoplatonism kind of as this on ramp for him to Christianity, because prior to Neoplatonism, when he was in church, he'd hear people say like. The hand of God was at work, and he literally thought God had a hand. Like he couldn't conceive of like an immaterial substance, and so he said the thing that Neoplatonism gave him was an ability to think about a substance that wasn't material. And he thinks if he didn't kind of have that, he couldn't have gotten to sort of Orthodox Christianity, or it helped him make sense of. Some other things. He brought a lot of other stuff with him too. It's not like, it's not like he didn't also bring other things too. But yeah, yeah. Cynthia.
Something that I've noticed in, like, throughout my young adulthood is that the definition of young adulthood keeps stretching, and so like, what used to be like, 18 to 25, and becomes 18 to 30, then 18 to 35.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. I'm trying to like make it older. And looking at the idea of restlessness and kind of makes me wonder if one of the reasons why, not just because everyone wants to be young, but because this restlessness that kind of defines young adulthood keeps on like is. Expanding where you have 35-year-olds, it's kind of that still, but then looking at, we talked about how even after Augustine's conversion, there's still a struggle. So, like, is there ever a point where the restlessness is actually dealt with?
Yes. Yes. The final book of the first 10, so there's 13 chapters, the first 10 chapters are more or less his story, and then the last 3 chapters are like, what is going on here? Deep philosophical reflections on time and history and memory, and then the last one is really, what strikes me is often an unusual read of Genesis 1, and he's looking for images of the church in Genesis 1. It's interesting. I'm not... Anyway, but what he does, the book begins with we're restless. And where it culminates is the seventh day where God rests from his work. That is where God is bringing creation. That was the intended purpose. That was like where we're going. And so he says basically what my story is like a microcosm of the macro, like of everything. Like if I get a taste of rest, it's because God is bringing the whole world to find rest, to sort of things will be made right. So his answer is sort of, you can have tastes of it now, but it's something that it's not, you don't get it in this life. It never is totally, totally settled. But for him, I mean, a big part of that was, coming to the end of himself and realizing he backed himself into a corner. And just sort of, yeah, where he ends is where rest begins, actually, where he lets go. Like, he was just looking for it in all the wrong places. Is there a song, Looking for Love in All the Wrong Places?
Yes, sir.
It's like, there. It's funny, you, like, read Augustine, and he is just, like, he is way up or back or whatever. He, like, but, like, all of these songs are, like, him. Like, when I did this before, I kind of used some of the stuff from Bruce Springsteen, Everybody's Got a Hungry Heart. Sarah and I were talking once, and Lily really likes I Want to Dance with Somebody by Whitney Houston. And I was like, which is like, I want to dance with somebody who loves me. I'm like, that kind of is what Augustine wants. He wants, like, delight and fun, but he wants it, like, with God. Like, he doesn't just want, like, cool, cognitive, like, whatever. Like, he wants life. And he just hasn't found it in all of these other places that have kind of promised him. So his answer is, there is rest now, but it's not, you don't get it fully. Nothing gets it fully until God brings the world where it was intended, his original intention. If that sort of, yeah, I mean, in some ways it's an answer that you're like, really? That's it? But that's where I think that's to me some of, like, what I appreciated about Smith's way of, like, it's a recovery story. It's a story that is not going to give you some, you can fit yourself into this. You can see yourself in this story. And it's one that makes sense of the fact that, like, we're still struggling with bad habits. Like, we get tastes. But we're never like fully there. And I appreciate that because he doesn't oversell it. And I feel like I listen to too much stuff that oversells, you know, that, like, this is the way to your best life. This is the way. And it's in the church. It's outside of the church. It's, you know, it's kind of everywhere. So, yeah. Did someone have a hand up over here a bit ago? No? Okay. Oh, did you?
The moment's passed.
Okay. Do you want to say anything else back to that, or?
I don't know, just thinking about, like, when I turned, I think I've, like, definitely had restlessness, but then, like, when I think I'm going to be peaceful a lot of it. When I turned 26, it was like, that's it. I'm throwing off the mantle of young adult. I am full adult. Like, no more young adult for me. And yet I see, you know, friends who are, like, 35 still, like, you know, holding on to that title for all their worth. And I'm wondering, like, what is the hope for the 35-year-old who just doesn't see the end of the restlessness?
Yeah, I guess I'd want to just, I don't know, talk to that 35-year-old before I have a perfect plan for their life. I don't know. I think I'd want to just
move out of home, maybe.
Yeah. Sell your video game system. Is that a hand this time?
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's something to maturity, like the language of maturity, that could be helpful. You know, and I think maybe that gets lost in developing and extended adolescent, like, I don't know, all of these other ways of talking about it, and I also think, like, I long for a compelling vision of maturity, you know, like, there is so much idolizing of youth, that it's hard to know, like, what are you aiming for, like, what's exciting about maturing, and so I've been wondering, like, if another way of gauging something of maturity in yourself has to do with rest, like how you rest, how you find rest, how you can return to rest.
Yeah.
You know, when you realize you've been frantic duck legging. But yeah, so I don't know. I wonder about maturity. Because it seems like maturity is more the language of Scripture, too. Like, to mature in Christ, to grow up.
To grow up, Yeah.
What's interesting about that is, like, I think Paul talks about the language of maturity in Christ. Mm. But I don't know, like, Jesus says, unless you're...
Like a child,
right? So he's got these paradoxical metaphors going on.
And there's something of, like, the restfulness of children, or the ability to be at ease with themselves and it's secure, that we need to recover that so that we mature. That's part of the maturity.
A little bit like Psalm 131.
It's a good psalm. Mm-hmm. Tick?
I think this gets back to Fowler. You mentioned this guy Fowler. I think maybe I've been working with debris too long, but I think trying to come at it with a standard idea of what maturity means or what growth will mean is fatal. It's so different. And their paths are so different. And what they I found that with Fowler, I'm very restless with this book, he's having too orderly a progression, so I think we have to be really careful about saying what maturity means, because in no time this person will have flunked it, who's 60, and that person will have flunked it too or whatever, could there be a way of a peacefulness between a dynamic of dominion, which is a control, mastery, which is what grows radically from year to year as you start out as a tiny child, and it's apt to grow in one's life up until middle age and maybe even beyond that, and trust, which is the ability to trust, to be reliant on God and those who are trustworthy. And I think there's an interaction between trust and dominion that is what defines, I think, the life cycle, what defines growth. And when I think maturity is in having an amicable relationship between trust and dominion, because both are necessary, and that progression of the interaction between the two is everything to do with our growth. God would have us redeem both our dominion and our trust. I know that's too abstract without saying much more than I've talked about. But that's there's some sense of interaction there of a peacemaking between those two that I think is important in maturity. In so many different possible ways with different people.
I
wonder if one of the elements there is also contentment, because of ending that restless search for God and things in life. I guess maturity would take a lot of contentment with how life is for us, and I think that contentment can come out of resting in God for that ideal reality we all want, but maybe it just isn't found in this world itself. It's beyond it. We want something beyond it. So I wonder, maybe it's not a popular term nowadays to be content with where we're at, but maybe it would be part of that healing.
That's interesting. There's a different book from Augustine that has like something that I found helpful. The language, remember, is like pre-utilitarianism, so you have to not put all your modern associations on it. But Augustine, in this book called On Christian Teaching, says there's two basic postures you should have towards things, all things. You should either use them or enjoy them. And if you confuse the two, you're in huge trouble. And he says the only thing we're really meant... So we hear use and we think kind of cold and almost like abuse, which is not his intention at all. It's just that things have a purpose. They're built for something. you use your fork to get your salad. But he says, ultimately, we're called to enjoy God. And God is the only thing we're to enjoy. But our propensity, which I think for him is much more like find our worth, find our identity, kind of put all of our weight in something to receive delight from it, to receive meaning from it. And he says, our problem is we get it backwards all the time. We want God to do things for us, so we're kind of using God, do this for me. And then the things that he's given us that are good, we look to for this enjoyment, this significance, this worth, our identity. And he says, the problem is it's like a bad investment because you're just going to crush these things that you should be trying to use them, but you're enjoying them and you're going to crush them because they're not built to carry that much weight. And so again, the language I think is a little funny. One, because use sounds utilitarian, and then to say you shouldn't enjoy things in the world sounds pretty, like, you know, backwards. But the idea is, like, we receive the things in the world as a gift from God, and we can actually find delight in them and pleasure in them. But if we try to find all of our pleasure in them, it's just a recipe for trouble. And he presents it in a way that, like, it's not so much you should or you shouldn't. It's like, listen, it's a bad investment. You're just going to end up breaking everything, and you're gonna be kind of miserable. So again, the language is, again, it's 4th century. It's pre utilitarianism and all that stuff. But I think that distinction of trying to understand your relationship to something and what are you asking of it, and if you're asking it to give you rest. You know, if you're asking for it, you know, the rest and enjoyment there, you're going to crush it, and you're going to, but the bad crush it, not like crushing it, good crushing it. You're going to break it. And I don't know, I keep, that's been helpful for me because I found myself so disappointed in things in life sometimes, in people or in events or, and I realize, like, I'm looking for these things to give me my meaning and my dignity and my value when I could just be looking at them as, like, just good things. You know, good things that are gifts from God that God wants me to enjoy but not to become... it's sort of like the logic of idolatry, I think. Anyway, that's another lecture, another book. Anyone else have any other thoughts? Any questions? The new Kanye West came out today. New album dropped around noon. It's called Jesus is Lord. He's become a Christian and a gospel artist. So, anyway, it's a little subnivian of him, but sorry. But anyway, if no one else has anything... I think... Oh, yeah, more.
Well, I'm not sure exactly when this guy was on the earth or...
Mm-hmm.
It was a long time ago. At one point you gave him the list of temptations that he had.
Yeah.
Same thing as that today.
Yeah. I think it's incredibly... I feel like that's one of the... I love him for his honesty, and I find him a contemporary in all those things. And I can tend to think my problems are sort of unique to me or unique to my moment. And in some ways, they very much are, or can be. But there is, there's just some things that we, like, throughout the ages, they plague us all. Yeah, Marty.
I just wanted to comment about contentment and how Paul, I'm just wondering whether that is a real piece of maturity, is when Paul says, when he's writing from prison, I've learned the secret of contentment in every situation.
Yeah.
And then that makes me wonder, too, whether some of the restlessness that a lot of people feel today and the inability to want to embrace adulthood comes from our affluence and our overchoice and our non-commitment to anything. I mean, if you just think of it in terms of online dating, you know, I mean, there's lots of research on the fact that people think, well, how could I ever... commit to this person when, you know, when there's thousands of people online that could be better, that all I have to do is keep, you know, keep looking and keep looking, keep
rather
than this person that I actually grew up with or that I met in my local church or even somebody I had met online, but, you know, and sort of the non-willingness to commit in so many areas because of kind of our affluence and overchoice and that can lead to just profound discontent.
Yeah, fear of missing out.
Always, there's always going to be some. I mean, I think it even fits into the fact that people, we've noticed over the last few years, people have a much harder time like committing to saying, I'll meet you for dinner at such and such a time and place, because you can text at the last minute and change your mind. And, you know, we didn't used to be able to do that. You had to show up.
Or leave them hanging.
The sort of, you know, the kind of, well, change, leave our plans to the very last minute.
Yeah.
And because you can always, you know.
The loss of freedom that we're afraid of.
If you
agree a week ahead of time, you're kind of allowed to go to dinner someplace. Wow, you've lost your freedom for that.
Yeah. All of a sudden,
What could come up between now and then?
I'd rather do.
And then, I think like most people, it's rare that you're going to get a ton of like conflicting possibilities on a night. You know, I don't know if many people get all those offers, and then you end up not ever going. You know, that's like the fear of missing out. You actually just never, you maybe never really engage because you keep.
It actually just creates like paralysis.
Yeah.
But I wonder if those aren't issues that play into prolonged restlessness for young people, emerging adulthood getting longer and longer and longer, you know, and lasting longer.
Yeah.
Sartre had a fascinating image because he was so passionately committed to freedom. Sort of like going around and around the roundabout and deciding to not take every turn. Because you've got your choice available.
Yeah.
But if you take the one turn, all your choices are gone down that road.
Yeah.
You don't have your free choice anymore.
Yeah.
So you go round and round, and each road that you come to, you decide to come or not, and you exert your freedom.
And you saying that sparked it, for Augustine, freedom is not endless possibility. That to him is enslavement.
Mm-hmm.
For him, freedom is doing what we were designed for, and doing that well. It's not endless possibility, but doing what we were made for, and flourishing in that place. And so for him, it's quite a paradoxical thing. And, you know, as an adult coming to faith and then learning to submit himself to Christ is a painful and submit to the church really is not an easy thing, but he speaks of it as this is freedom to do what God commands of you is freedom, and which just to me, even as someone who I'm just sort of like I've just so breathed in the air that freedom is endless choices and endless possibilities. But I think his story is one that kind of following that freedom, he found himself backed into a corner and didn't have a way out.
I wonder if people today have much less of a sense that there is something that I'm for.
Yeah.
A teleological sense.
Yeah.
I think that's
fairly
rare.
Yes.
There's something that I'm for, and I need to decide it. If I miss that, I'm really wasting my time.
Yeah.
Just freedom itself would be.
That's why I see so much social activism. People creating their own definitions of what they're for.
All right, going once, going twice. All right, thank you.